Hey, it's Tony and Melissa. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast.
Here are some of the best parts from today's show. Hope you'll subscribe, share, and like us.
It's 9:30. Do you know what time it is? It's time for the Coffee Break Chat on WICC.
And today we have Stephanie Swantek, who is with the Be Safe Project Program Manager at Bridges Healthcare. She's joining us live right now. Thank you for being here, Stephanie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we are in the summer season. A lot of kids just graduated high school, some of which they're moving on to college in the fall. So it's a very exciting time. But we all remember being teenagers. And it doesn't really change year to year, generation to generation. There's always this pressure, I think, that's sort of lingering, especially if you've been in a relationship for a year, 2 years, even 6 months, and you feel the pressure of going away to college. Maybe kids might make decisions that aren't the healthiest in their relationships. First of all, can you tell us what are some of the common misconceptions that parents have? I think a lot of times parents may think, well, it's not going to be my child, or my child's probably not having sex. And, you know, do you feel that that's still a misconception that goes on today?
I think that parents are afraid to have these conversations with their children. So either they think things that are not going on, or they're completely aware of situations because they don't want to hear it. And so I feel that the more conversations and the more open and the more kind of parents kind of break down their own fears and misconceptions, the better with their students. And with that transition of exiting high school and going into college, you know, for a parent to better support even themselves through that own transition in regards to relationships with their child, sexual relationships, healthy relationships with drugs, alcohol, social or romantic relationships, is really also knowing the groups of whom their children are spending time with, as well as being able to navigate the college campus if their child is going to college, and knowing even the resources on the college campus in regards to like mental health, even campus security, health and wellness, and so that they can also, if they're not comfortable with these topics and these situations, that they can also connect their student with people who are more comfortable so that they can best support that child throughout, you know, each facet of their life.
Well, also, how important is it for parents to step in and talk to their kids? I mean, not for anything, this is a very easy subject to approach. You know, it's not like, you know, pass the salt and are you having sex? I mean, it's rough. It's very, very, very hard. And it's, let's face it, for some of us, it's embarrassing.
Yes, absolutely. Well, to be honest, these conversations, though, should start way before like this last, you know, them moving on to college or last year of high school. I mean, these conversations should really start, you know, when a child is developing, you know, puberty, healthy relationships, like anatomy, and really talking about their body parts, like what adds to what their body parts are, not private parts. Well, or you can say private parts so no one else is touching those, but really using the anatomical names of those parts, so that when you have these conversations, whether it's in school or you know, a trusting adult is having these conversations, they feel more compelled to speak up if something's happening to them, which is also, you know, prevention of someone taking advantage of them. But they also feel more comfortable asking questions if they're curious about something. But you being comfortable with this terminology, and that starts with parenting, and then obviously for the child. And there's books that can teach these things as well, even in regards to, like, you know, bedtime stories and talking about how your bodies change and that's okay, and just healthy relationships in general.
Stephanie Swantek, who's the project manager of Be Safe Project, I just have to be devil's advocate because I've heard from my own friends when I was growing up, their parents, or even now as a parent, I disagree a lot of times with my friends and how they're raising their kids, and they disagree with how I do things. I'm very honest and open, and I feel this is something that we'll be addressing very early on, especially raising a boy. And I know my friends feel differently. There's always that idea of, well, if I address it too early, I'm putting ideas in their heads, which is a lot of people feel that way. But I don't know. I mean, what do you say to that? You know, if they're 9 and 10 and you hear about middle schoolers or even elementary school kids starting to engage in relationships or engage in behaviors, is it something that you bring up that you're now, are you now teaching them something they didn't know, or is that really not the case?
Absolutely. Well, that's a great question. So, again, it's knowing where your student, your child is developmentally, you know, so whether they're 9, 10, as a boy, for example, you really want to talk to them about consent and boundaries and respecting other boys and other girls, right, or anything in between, but respecting people's space, what they're comfortable with, speaking up. If you see something, say something. But really all about what feels good for them, healthy versus unhealthy relationships. And even having conversations about the word pleasure, right? Because we many times associate the word pleasure with sexual pleasure. But pleasure just means feeling good. So even when you eat something, it's pleasurable. So using these types of words, that they're like, you know what, this space, whether someone touched me or I'm touching somebody else, does not feel right for me. It's not pleasurable. It just teaches kids to be more in touch with their body and knowing what feels good, what doesn't, and knowing how to navigate those red flags and seeing them. Even in regards to teachers and coaches, you hear these stories, right, kind of filter through the news. And it's how do these things happen? But it's these exact conversations that are not happening that should be happening to prevent these things from happening.
We continue our conversation with Stephanie Swantek, Be Safe Project Program Manager with Bridges Healthcare in Milford. Now, Steph, and what I'm about to say, I'm not putting it on the girls, but please don't think that. But the other day, we were at the beach. Okay, my wife and I, we went to the beach. We were, you know, just hanging out there in the sun. I got up to get a cold drink from the truck that was over there. And when I got to the truck, there were like three, I'm going to say little girls. They couldn't have been any more than 15, 16. And, you know, for a lack of a way to put it out, they were letting it all hang out. There was really almost nothing left to the imagination. And I just started thinking to myself, first of all, if this was my daughter, oh my God, I'd kill her. That'd be number one. number two, this kind of like, now what? What is the boy supposed to think? What is the boy thinking at this point? Because I know when I was a kid, you never saw this. Now, I'm going back 50 years, but when I was a kid, when we went to sex education class, we were mortified, absolutely mortified. And they were using all the terms and everything like that. We looked down at our shoes and we were like, oh my God, get us out of here. We were like mortified. It was terrible. But at the beach, I was thinking to myself, I was like, my God, how you know, wow, this is out there. There's so much of this going on. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm having a hard time articulating it. But
Yeah, I hear you. And I, what you're basically, I mean, what you're saying is that our kids, especially females, are growing up in a very sexualized generation, and they're being sexualized. And for females, right? What are they? Again, last time I talked about this, it's like who are they surrounding themselves? What messages are they receiving in regards to body image, what they need to look like? And a lot of times, you know, 14, 15, they all want to look older than what they are.
Yeah.
And so the less clothes they wear, the more sexy they feel. And they think being sexy, someone will give them attention and give them love, and they'll get something out of it, but it's the messages that they're receiving that are teaching them to do that.
Right.
But
when I'm looking there at the beach the other day, this is what I meant to say. What kind of message are they putting out?
Mm-hmm.
Forget the messages they are receiving. What are they putting out there, you know?
So I don't think they fully know what they're putting out there. They're just good feeling point. Pretty. They're just feeling good. They're just being, they're wearing what they're being told to wear by the media. And that's why I go back also to boys understanding what consent is and boundaries. And if that's not my body, I have to ask someone to always touch them. And I need to respect someone's space. And if they're not comfortable with that, then I shouldn't be here. But it's all about the media, and it's how what we do and how we teach our young girls and boys of how to dress and how to act. but it's these messages that they're receiving by the media.
But I do think parents need, they should take, I do think, some ownership of that, though. I mean, again, this is dating myself back, you know, 15, almost 20 years. Again, my mom took me shopping, that may, immature, however you want to call it. My mom took me shopping until I had my own money to buy my own clothing. I mean, if my parents were buying the clothing, they had a right to say if I could or couldn't wear it. And, of course, I went to a school where I had a uniform at school. But outside of school, when I bought jeans, they were never low-rise or jeans or whatever you want to call them. They were never, I could never wear shirts that were above the belly button. I mean, there were certain standards my parents put on me, and they put them on my brothers as well. You know, you can't have baggy shorts falling below your butt, you know, whatever the case may be.
Right. Sure, sure.
But you're saying that these were your parents' standards. How many of these kids are, let's say, going to the beach and they wear a certain outfit, a certain bathing suit, their mother is dropping them off at the beach or whatever it is. Okay, I'll be back in 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then they run into the ladies' room and change.
They change. But I guess what I'm getting at is, see, for me, I don't know. I had a lot of respect for my parents' wishes. I knew, you know, where money was coming from. And I guess, Steph, I guess my question is, are parents not getting involved enough? Are parents scared of their kids? Are they scared to have these conversations? Are they scared to kind of say, you know what, if I find out that you're wearing this or your girlfriends are taking pictures and you're not dressed this way, you're not going to the beach the rest of the summer. Are parents scared to say that? Because I know for my mom, I had the fear of God in me. If she ever found out that I had short shorts or a belly top shirt on or something, I wouldn't have been let out of the house for 3 months. I'm going to be totally straight up. But do you feel that parents don't do enough to make sure that their kids are safe and making good decisions?
So I think these are all wonderful questions. I think this is very multi-layered. So for one, when a girl's completely exposing themselves, one, it could just be like developmentally, they just want to feel, that's what they're seeing everyone wear, so that's what they're wearing. But then, you know, if they're older, I would also take a step back and being like, you know, if a person, doesn't matter what gender, you know, et cetera, what size, a certain person's wearing very minimal clothing, what is it actually saying about how they feel about themselves? And while it may look like they feel good about themselves, it also may be the opposite. It may just feel like the only thing that's going for me is my body, and the way I feel doesn't matter, but this is who I am, and I am my body, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does.
And I need to use it in my advantage to attract or just to move forward, because this is all I am, so I have to showcase it. Mm-hmm. So that's one. With parents, I think parents are very fearful. I think sometimes some parents are, for many reasons, right, whether it's generational, in which maybe even parents dress very, very sexy. And so again, that even those messages that child is receiving, it could be even passed down from their mother or their cousins or their aunt, because that's just the style of the family, quote unquote. Or it just could be, I just don't want to have another argument with my kid and I need a break, or I'm just so busy, you know, with my own relationship or with work or with their siblings, that I just don't have the time or the patience, or I don't feel supported enough to have these conversations with my kids.
So,
it's so layered, you know?
Oh, it absolutely is. It's a very loaded question. And I guess just to kind of wrap up, I know you and I have talked about, you have in the works some different events that if parents have more questions, if they want to figure out a way to talk, or if they can't and they need some professional help to talk to their kids, are there things you guys are setting up to help parents out?
Yes. Thank you for asking that. So we're actually going to be having, I'm still confirming the date, but it will be here in Milford, most likely at the Boys and Girls Club, as well as one other location, in probably one or two in July, as well as possibly one in August, but it'll be in the next upcoming month. And they're going to be free conversations, workshops with parents in regards to how you have these conversations, when do you have these conversations, mm-hmm. and how do you have them, what they should look like, based on the age of your child and the developmental, where they are developmentally. So we will be having those at Bridges or through Bridges, and I'll be happy to send something out and talk to you more about that in the future. But it will be coming up in July, and we're really excited about those events, because these are all scary topics, and that's also part of it is even having these conversations, approaching it in a way of like, this isn't comfortable for me and it's not comfortable for you, so let's meet in the middle, and I love you and I want you to be happy. And so what does that look like for us as a family and for you as an individual?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stephanie Swantek, who is the program manager of the Be Safe Project, we thank you so much for tackling some of, well, mine and Tony's questions for sure, because we pile them on, but certainly tackling a very difficult subject for a lot of parents in our listening area. We thank you so much.
Thank you so much, both of you, and have a wonderful day, and I'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you so very, very much. Boy, am I glad that I have boys.
We got more Shecks on this show than we probably know what to do with. My little sister, Annie Lynn, joins us now live on the line. Hey, babe.
Hi.
Tony thinks we all sound alike. We all just have this high-pitched, hi.
No, she sounds like she's 12 years old, actually.
She's 20, surprisingly.
Oh, and I got to tell you, I saw that little clip of you dancing. You know, you look exactly like your mother.
Really? I get that a lot.
She's like, oh, really? Yeah, so Annie Lynn, of course, obviously I follow your dancing career, but I've been sharing it with Tony and sharing it with the listeners since yesterday. Talk to us about the opportunity to be on national television. Yesterday, my sister said to me before she all came on, she said, well, I don't know why this is such a big deal. You worked in television. But I said, no, I worked in local television. I've never been seen by millions of people. So what was that like to be on So You Think You Can Dance?
It was so surreal. I got so much feedback from, like, so many different people that have been in my lifetime and still are. So it was really cool to, like, hear from different people from all over. But it was also just extremely, like, weird seeing myself on television. And I got to watch it with, like, close friends and family. So it was really fun, too, since I don't remember kind of any of the experience during that day, just because it was, like, crazy to actually be happening in front of a live, you know, audience and live judges and everything. So it was really cool, though, and it, like, brought back a lot of memories that in the moment were so tense and stuff, and now that I can watch, it's like, I don't know, a dream come true.
People only get to see that little piece, you know, but what kind of preparation went into that few minutes that you were on TV? I mean, that must have been hours and hours of preparation.
Yeah, it was a lot. Just for, like, a minute clip, for example, you know, they have you out the door, like, already dancing by, like, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't go to bed until about 12 p.m. at night. Ooh. So it was just a lot, but it was cool, you know. It's a cool experience. You dance all day, and then you do that for all those hours just for that, you know, 10 second to, like, a minute clip. So,
and even
I
though,
it.
Yeah, even though I know you're my sister, so I follow your career, but it was shocking to us, Tony, when we were hearing, I don't really know actually a lot about these national shows, like when you think about Dancing with the Stars or America's Got Talent. How many people were you up against, Annie Lynn, when you were doing the show? Because they only show 4 episodes of auditions and you ended up on it. So how many people were you up against to actually get onto the show?
So originally around 3,500 try out, and by the time you get to the round that was last night, they cut down to around 60 people.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, so it was really hard, but it was very fun, and it feels like a major success in my dance career.
Well, you didn't win the big prize, obviously. We're sorry for that. But now, does this open the doors for other things now? I mean, has anybody called you? Has MGM called you to make a movie or anything like that?
It also opens a lot of doors. It's good to get your name out there and, like, your face out there to the producers and the judges. And also the friends that I made out there, they're all, like, high-time dancers, which is very, very honoring to, like, dance beside them all. So, yeah, I mean, just exposure within the dance world is huge.
I don't think I've ever asked you this. Are you going to try again? I don't think I've even asked you that.
Yeah, I am going to try out again if the show comes back in the spring.
But you may be on again next week, though, because you, as we saw in the episode last night, you got a golden ticket. So even though we know you don't win in the end because you're back here in Connecticut and you'd be out in L.A. if you were still shooting the show, but we know your journey's not over.
Right, yeah, because you go to the Academy next.
That's wild. I wanted to see what happens at the Academy, Tony.
Yeah, that sounds like a wild time. It sounds like a great way to make a living, I'll tell you. Amy Lynn, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but we'll be watching for you. If you're going to be on again, we'll be looking for you. Absolutely.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for talking to me.
All right. Anytime. All right.
She knows you have to talk to me every day, so she's like, oh, God, he's willing to talk to me, too? That's amazing.
All right, I won't hold it against you. Okay, listen up, because summer is here. That's no secret. And we're going to be sharing the roads. All right, you've got summer travel, you've got construction zones. It's downright dangerous out there, and it's very, very dangerous, especially for those folks working on the highway. We have to work together and be safe. Now, you've not only got the work zones, but you've got disabled motorists, you've got DOT workers, tow trucks, police, fire trucks. Give them room, man. Give them room. When you see those disabled trucks, when you see them on the side of the road, when you see them in the breakdown lane, you've got to move over. Get away from them. Now, I understand sometimes that's not an ideal situation, and you can't move over because the people in the other lane don't let you move over. I get it. It happens to me all the time. But if you can't move over, slow down. It is scary out there, and people are getting hurt. Or even worse, I mean, I see it every day, Melissa. You know, on the way home, I get on the thruway, and I've got maybe, if there's no traffic, maybe a 25-minute ride, a 30-minute ride back to Stanford. You see it every single day. You know, people are in the breakdown lane, and people are whizzing by them at 80 mm-hmm. miles per hour. Mm-hmm. It is downright frightening. And mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but I get scared for those people in the disabled lane. Like, you see somebody pass at 80 miles an hour past them, and I find myself going, oh, hey, whoa. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's really, really scary stuff. It really is.
Well, I think a lot of times people don't think it's going to be me. It's not going to be me who hits somebody, or it's uh-huh. not going to be me who swerves. But we just had that instance, Tony, a week or two ago, where the trooper was in the breakdown lane helping somebody and got hit by somebody else. And I just think sometimes we're so quick to think, well, we hear about it, but it's not going to be me. And I think the other thing that scares me, Tony, is how often when people are going in these construction zones, this is what gives me heart palpitations, is when people are texting mm-hmm. and they're going through. And I think, okay, it's already horrible that you check your phone regularly, but the fact that you've got cones to dodge, or when the big barriers are up, like on the Merritt Parkway, or you go down to one lane. I saw it just coming into work a couple weeks ago when they, right here, because we're right off of Lafayette Square, they had the cones up where it was blocking the exit we usually get off of at first, and somebody merging, I was sure was going to hit me at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I looked over and this is them. Down on their phone, looking straight down.
I know.
First of all, it's dark out. There are cones up. You can't see anything. What are you looking at?
Well,
what
you know,
are you doing?
Just this morning. Now, you hit the parkway, both sides, north and southbound, exit 40B to around exit 44. It is just wall-to-wall construction. The right lane is down, then you're moving a little bit, the left lane is down. It's every single morning, except for Mondays when they have the day off. But for the most part, it's wall-to-wall work zone. And, you know, when you're coming up on a work zone, I don't know about you, but I automatically start to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to slow down. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're going through those areas now. For me, 35, 40 miles per hour. I don't want to hurt anybody, you know. But you always, it happened this morning. There was some clown behind me. I wasn't going fast enough. And he's hitting his brights on and off, on and off. In other words, hey, come on. Come on, let's get going here. And it's like, no, man, I'm not going to do it. You can sit there and do your brights and your horn and whatever
all
you're
you
going
to
do.
Yeah,
I'm not doing it. You know,
yeah.
It's funny. People, they're so impatient. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, really, come on.
I know. What are you rushing to? And I do think that's a good opportunity. You bring up a good point for parents, Tony. If you have young drivers or you have intimidated drivers, let them know that they do not have to be bullied by people behind them, because I think a lot of times drivers, most of the time, are followers, and they see, okay, well, everyone else is kind of keeping a 65 mile an hour, so I guess I should also. And no, you do not need to do that. First of all, there are signs up saying you need to cut your speed down in half.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are already a nervous driver, which is fine, or you're a defensive driver, don't let people bully you. I think Connecticut is just prone to drivers feeling they need to speed up in the slow lane, slow down in the, because I don't know who they're keeping up with, but they need to just chill out. And I think they intimidate a lot of drivers out there. So if you do have young drivers, let them know to just kind of swat them off. Don't worry about
it. We have become a society of rush, rush, rush. Let's get there as fast as we can. And you know something? It should be a curse word. I really believe this. multitasking.
Oh, I know.
It should be a curse word.
Mm-hmm.
Because once we started multitasking, that's when things started to go right downhill.
Everything became chaotic. Yeah, it's true.
It's very, very true. You've got to pay attention, especially on the roads. And I bring that up this morning because we see it every single day. I see it early in the morning, 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever it is. And then you see it in the afternoon. Just people don't care. They just don't care.
And it doesn't matter the hour, Tony, because I was thinking the same thing. It was funny you brought it up because you take the Merritt in. I take 95 in. Same thing with 95 right in the Stratford area. Both sides, north and southbound, had the cones up. Everything went down to one lane for just a little bit, not too long, but enough where if people didn't see the signs, hey, coming up in half a mile, you're going to go down to one lane, all of a sudden they also will like hit the brakes and you're stuck behind them. And if you're not paying attention to the signs, you're now the fender bender person. You're the one who just caused an accident, or you're swerving to stay away from them and you may hit someone or hit a barrier, hurt yourself, hurt somebody else. And it's just, as soon as you see lights, cones, any of that, I mean, come on, just, it's okay.
Yeah,
we're going to get there.
It's okay.
You're going to get there.
WICC 600's Tony and Melissa in the Morning take a closer look at the Park City. Here's Lenny Grimaldi from Only in Bridgeport.
All right. It's getting serious, Lenny. You have your own intro and everything now. You see that?
You know, Tony and Melissa, you hit me in the big time here. I'm starting to think we should name this segment of the show after the Beatles song, Rain. Because every time I'm on Tuesday,
I was thinking the same thing. This is like the fifth day in a row. I thought about it this morning when I looked at the forecast, Lenny. I looked and I thought, you've got to be kidding me.
Like the angel of death for your show.
Yeah. Last week when it rained on Thursday, I looked at the forecast. I said, what's going on? Lenny's not on today.
Listen, I bring rain. Everyone has a hobby. That's mine.
All right.
We bring stories, bring all kinds of stuff.
All right. Of course, Lenny writes the blog Only in Bridgeport, and today he talks about the Park City for a few minutes like he does every Tuesday.
Yeah, and something that, Lenny, we were keeping an eye on, obviously, as soon as we heard earlier in the year that Aresta Johnson was going to stop being the superintendent, we knew that they were going to find an interim, and we know that they took on Tastani yesterday was who they ended up, they voted in Michael Tastani. My question, I guess, Lenny, is in your opinion, I know that this is interim, it's only going to be for a year till they find a permanent person. Would Michael Tastani be in the running to become permanent, like depending on what he does this year, or you don't think so?
Well, that's a good question, Melissa. The way they set up this process, the people who applied for the one-year interim superintendent job cannot participate in the longer-term search. So this is one year and done, unless they change the rules. So when they set up this process to select someone on an interim basis for one year, part of the rule said you can apply for the one-year interim school chief job, but you can't seek the longer-term job. So simultaneously, what's going on is Michael Tastani last night was chosen by the school board to serve for interim superintendent for about one year. Meanwhile, the school board will be hiring a firm to do a national search to place a more permanent school chief, and that process is going to take upwards of a year.
Wow.
But he's, Tastani is a classic case of relationships matter, right? He's been the head of adult education. He's the local guy, here. People know him. By a 5-3 vote last night, he got it. There was a number of people in the district who felt that Jonathan Bryce, who's the associate superintendent of schools in Maryland, in Montgomery County Schools in Maryland, was someone who was very qualified for the job. But, Tastani leveraged his relationships to get this one-year appointment.
All right. Also, I noticed that Joe Ganim, he opened up his downtown campaign quarters Monday night.
Sure. If you're the mayor of Bridgeport and you want quick access to your campaign headquarters, the only sensible thing to do under the circumstances is to open up a headquarters right across from your office. So it's a quick commute that the mayor and his supporters have. If you're a city employee and you support the mayor after you're working hours at City Hall, you can walk right across the street and segue to the campaign if you want. So, he has it right down on Broad Street. It's across from the Bridgeport Public Library downtown. And last week, State Senator Marilyn Moore, who's one of Joe Ganim's challengers, also opened a campaign headquarters downtown. So for Ganim, it's great access. But also it says about downtown, how much it's coming back. Downtown now has thousands of people living downtown. When Tony and I were young reporters, you had no one living downtown. You could just hear echoes. But now you have thousands of people downtown. So it says a lot about the neighborhood itself. Coming back, the two mayoral candidates have their campaign headquarters downtown.
Lenny Grimaldi, who's with Only in Bridgeport, his blog online. I think when you think Bridgeport, you think the summertime. Immediately, of course, you're going to think of the Barnum Festival. So we've got a lot of stuff that's coming up this weekend. Can you talk to us about that?
Absolutely. There's loads of stuff going on. So starting this week, you can see a musical production of Barnum, Javier Colon, who was the original voice, a native of Bridgeport and raised in Stratford. He's going to play the role of Barnum. So if you go to fairfieldcenterstage.com, it's a free show. It's a great book. I've seen the show on Broadway that's coming here locally. It's going to be outdoors at the Fairfield Museum Commons, June 27th, 28th, and 29th, and it's free. So also the comedian Lisa Lampanelli is going to be part of the show as well. So check that out. You get Friday night, you have the Seaside Park fireworks, 9 p.m. at Seaside Park. The next day on Saturday, you get the Champions on Parade at Kennedy Stadium at 6. And then you have the Great Street Parade on Sunday at Seaside Park. So last year they did something new. The parade itself is confined to Seaside Park, and I think it's fabulous because you already have a built-in audience there at the beach and the ballparks and so on. It's this beautiful setting along the waterfront at Seaside Park. So there's a lot of free parking, and the logistics of parking is important. People can park for free at the University of Bridgeport lots. There's a grassy area in front of Marina Hall opposite the Banshell Field. All lots by the baseball fields off Atlantic Street. There's plenty of street parking on the UB campus as well. So you can go park for free, walk up. It's a great day. I went last year. It's a fabulous parade. So check it out. So the parade starts at the old bathhouse at the west end of the beach and follows the seawall out to Main Street. So check that out this weekend. Lots of good stuff going on.
Yeah, Barnum Festival, always a lot of fun. And Lenny, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but we appreciate it. Don't forget, the blog is onlyinbridgeport.com. Check it out. Lenny speaks of all things Bridgeport. Lenny, I thank you so much. We'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Yeah, baby, I'll bring some rain.
All right.
Looking forward to it.
Well expected. All right.
Well, we're going
to
talk really about one item. If you remember, I'm not sure that you'll remember that. This event, Tony, but not sure you're going to believe that it was that long ago. But it was it would be 9 years ago on this date. We were still reeling from the effects of a tornado that hit here in Bridgeport. Remember that?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And
sure.
June 24th. It was June 24th, 2010, about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Strong thunderstorms came out of New York State. Continued to move across east in the areas and came in from the north and west and then hit our city with severe weather, lots of wind, and a tornado. Winds at Sikorsky were up to 78 miles per hour. Unofficial reports over 100 miles per hour caused just tremendous damage here in the city, power outages, and unbelievably there were no deaths. I mean, we have certainly one of the populated urban areas in the state, and with a tornado hitting it, it just was amazing that it was a lot of damage, but injuries and certainly no deaths. So that was, believe it or not, 9 years ago. We were waking up to looking at what still the damage was around and still power trying to be put back on and things like that. So wanted to bring that Tuesday trivia tidbit because for me, it's unbelievable that it was 9 years ago.
Well, you know, and around here, first of all, I wasn't here. I had already gone home after the tornado hit. But I know that here they evacuated the building because on top of our roof here, the air conditioning system actually moved. I mean, the tornado took it right up off of its hinges, and they didn't know if it was going to come off the building. They didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
So everybody,
and the structure was worried about the structure of the building,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they didn't know what was going on. So we were all evacuated, or the people that were still here were evacuated, and I don't know how long it was before they were able to come back. But I remember in the city, the city had its share of problems. I mean, the Barnum Museum has never been the same since that tornado. It's just hasn't gotten its act together. I don't know what the holdup is on all of that. I don't know if it's money or what the story is, but the Barnum Museum sustained some pretty serious damage after that tornado 9 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember you, Scott Appleby, the emergency operations director here in the city, showing video. They have, of course, video around the down in Washington Avenue, and the video was just amazing because you see, you know, the wind kind of with the little trees, you know, moving a little bit. Then this fog just came in, and then the fog cleared, and all the trees were broken. Everything was a disaster. It was literally the most amazing video of the tornado moving through. You didn't see the funnel because it's really tough to see a funnel here in Connecticut. It's mostly enshrouded by rain, and that's why you see that dense fog or cloud mask come in. You don't really get to see it as you do in the Midwest, but nonetheless, when you see something like that here in Connecticut, you're pretty sure that something tornadic is happening, because when you have a thunderstorm and that type of a weird fog comes in, trust me, folks, it's not just fog. It's not a quiet little peaceful, you know, foggy thing going on. It's going to be horrible once that fog lifts, and that's exactly what happened. It came in, you saw the video camera things, and then all of a sudden when it came out, it's like somebody came in, literally changed the set on a play. It was just disaster. Yeah, it's like, oh my God, that just happened in about 4 seconds.
Yeah. That's the perfect way to put it. That's right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think Melissa has an update on the Barnum Museum. How far along are they on that?
Yeah, so only because you were just asking before, it shows there's a report saying that the exterior renovations are actually supposed to start this summer. And the entire project is supposed to be done by 2025. I mean, it sounds like, it just sounds like there was an awful lot. Like you said, Tony, there was an awful lot that was done to this. And the executive director basically was saying, you know, like she couldn't imagine that 9 years later it would take this long. But they finally are like turning a corner, and they're going to hopefully start those renovations, at least on the outside of the building, this summer. And everything should be complete. I know that they're reconfiguring, trying to figure out maybe a new way to represent a lot of Barnum history and everything, and redoing it and bringing some new elements than was there before. But yeah, 9 years, not a lot has been done there. It's still pretty beat up.
Well, hopefully once they get started, it'll be quick to get all the repairs in, and they can, you know, I mean, it's been open for business, but it just hasn't been the same. And if you've never been there, it's just a great place to catch up on P.T. Barnum and what he was all about, you know. So, all right, Bill, thank you so very, very much. We'll catch
you're
up
very welcome.
In a little bit. That's Bill Jackelman, our chief meteorologist here on WACC 600. You know, it's very rare to see something translate across all generations like this, but they did some research. And they asked some people to name the top slang terms that they use to describe something that's positive or favorable. And two words dominated the list for baby boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials.
Really?
Yeah, those words are cool and awesome.
Okay.
So they're used across the board. I use both words, to be honest with you. The two words tied overall of people who rank them as one of the top three terms that they use most. And it's right across the board. Boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials. And the third on all three lists was the word nice. I use that too as well.
Yeah. Wow. That's
so the top terms for boomers was awesome, cool, nice, neat, and superb. Gen Xers, it's awesome, cool, nice, neat, and wicked. For millennials, it's cool, awesome, nice, dope.
I was just going to say, where's dope?
Yeah, what does dope mean?
It's just something that the kids say. It's so dope.
Okay.
It sounds funny hearing you say it, though.
And
Tony, say this show is so dope.
This show is so dope. And neat, that was the final word there.
Neato.
Now, older Americans are most likely to say awesome, cool, superb, neat, and far out. And people still say far out, groovy.
I don't know. Come on.
And young people, now, here we go. Maybe you can help me out with this.
Sure.
Young people are much more likely to use five terms. Dope, lit. What does that mean?
This party is so lit. Like, it's vibrant. There's a lot going on.
Okay.
It's exciting.
All right. Fire.
I don't know if I know that one. Anything that I know, honest to God, is because I have a 20-year-old sister who tries to teach me, but I'm awful at it. Go on. I've never heard of... I would assume fire is like, oh, yeah, this is awesome.
Okay.
I don't know.
Sick.
Yeah, that's so sick. Now, like, whoa, you know, that catch that, you know, an NFL catch, that was a sick catch.
Well, now, see, my kids, they use sick quite a bit. And for the longest time, I thought it meant the opposite. Like, if it was sick, it was bad. You know,
yeah.
You're feeling sick. You know, I mean,
it's same with dope. I mean, when you think about it, dope when I was growing up was always, I mean, not the drug dope, but dope, like you're dopey, you're an oddball, you're, mm-hmm. you know, you're off.
Okay.
But the fact that we say, yeah, that's so dope, it doesn't make make sense.
And then there's Gucci, whatever that means.
Okay, that's something I don't understand. I laugh whenever people say, oh, yeah, that's so Gucci.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that means or where that comes from, but I know rap artists use it. I sound so ridiculous saying that, but... you know Paul Pacelli's producer, Aaron?
Mm-hmm.
He taught me Gucci. One of the days that we were in here, he's like, ah, girl, that's so Gucci. I said, I have no idea what what you're saying.
So I wouldn't know if he's insulting me or what.
Right. I thought he was calling me like a designer or something because I think of Gucci, the designer, but he just laughed back at me. But I don't know where that comes from. I'm sorry.
All right.
That's
well,
the best I could do.
We'll have to hang out with Aaron a little bit more because he seems to be hip.
Do we, though? Do we need to start saying Gucci on the air? I don't know.
Me? I won't be doing it. No.
Yeah, I think I'm going to stick with you on that one. I don't know if we need to hang out with Aaron to keep saying Gucci.
Okay.
I think awesome is fine.
All right, you talked me into it. I'm not hanging out with Aaron.
There you go.
Okay, great.